So gaining the best possible understanding of context before making decisions produces better decisions. For example, military commanders in Iraq and Afghanistan quickly learned that destroying infrastructure used by enemy forces might make perfect sense militarily, but in that environment and in that kind of conflict, the adverse effect on local civilians could be detrimental to the long-term objective of gaining their support and ending the campaign. The decision to destroy buildings, bridges, and markets, and even Taliban smuggling routes, as we saw and heard in Chapter 3, or leave them intact, depended on an appreciation of context. An understanding of context is best achieved when there is collaboration at every level of the organization. We call this the co-creation of context, to make the point that it is everyone's responsibility and to highlight, again, that speed matters in the era of digital echoes. Back to General Dempsey's drive home and the alternate route offered by Waze. Waze is context built in real time by anonymous participants without ownership in decisions or their outcomes. But what if context could be produced at the speed of Waze by participants who feel like they belong and have a stake in the success of the organization? Decisions would clearly be better. Typically, senior leaders gain an understanding of context by pulling it from within their organizations. In the military, senior leaders publish Priority Information Requirements, PIR, which tell subordinates what these leaders want to know. But we would be more effective as leaders if individuals within the organization were organized and encouraged not just to tell us what we say we want to know, but also what they think we need to know. Furthermore, when lists of desired information are generated at the top of an organization, they're usually focused on things that could go wrong, things that could take the organization off plan. Few organizations, especially big ones, ask their junior members about opportunities the organization may be missing. Establishing processes to allow our organizations to co-create context will produce better decisions and, under the right leadership conditions, produce them faster. Better decisions made faster is what we need in an era that requires us to overcome the inertia of complexity and react quickly in the face of change. Finding ways to gain the support and insight of the entire organization is imperative. Leaders must recognize that though their experience lends them a valuable discerning eye, a real and complete understanding of complex issues requires perspectives from every part of the organization. We can't expect to solve our problems effectively until we have this thorough grasp of the problem. In discovering options, the best ideas do not always come from the top of the organization. In fact, it is often the team members on the front line who have the most creative solutions, which may turn out to be the ones that save us. Our challenge as leaders is to empower the entire organization to take part in understanding the problem the team is facing and to encourage individuals at all levels to suggest potential ways to reach our desired outcomes. Remember General Dempsey's young captain on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border? After explaining to the general the difference between hierarchical organizations and decentralized networks, he went on to suggest that although the army had gone to great lengths and spared no effort to push capability to the edge, it had not done nearly enough to harvest the resulting knowledge produced there. When General Dempsey asked the young captain what he needed in order to accomplish his mission under the very harsh conditions of the Hindu Kush, he was pleased that the captain didn't present him with a wish list of resources. The captain already had an impressive array of weaponry, giving him a significant advantage in both day and night operations. He had access to the highest levels of intelligence and was able to maintain accurate situational awareness of who and what was operating on the ground and in the air near his combat outpost. His soldiers were networked with a suite of the most modern communications equipment. His resupply needs were being met. On reflection, General Dempsey realized that this 28-year-old captain had more tools at his immediate disposal than he himself had had during his time in Baghdad, with 32,000 soldiers spread out over 700 square kilometers of urban sprawl. What the young man did seek, though, was Dempsey's assurances that what the captain knew in his small piece of Afghanistan was making its way back to the various headquarters above him and all the way to the Pentagon, so that the top brass had an understanding of the challenges he faced. Dempsey couldn't give him that assurance. Although the U.S. military had done a superb job of empowering the lowest tactical levels with every possible capability available, giving its soldiers a decided edge against their enemies, the military had not yet figured out how to harvest the knowledge available at the edge in a timely and effective manner. In an organization spread from the Potomac River to the Himalayas, gaining a common understanding of context remained challenging. General Dempsey realized that often, perhaps even usually, the most important piece of information that a senior leader needs is one that comes from the edge of the organization, not from its center. And we can be sure we're accomplishing what we set out to accomplish only if we insist upon and enable the co-creation of context throughout the organization. Easier said than done, but as technology has improved, it has produced opportunities for leaders at all levels to co-create context and in so doing dramatically improve performance. This leadership principle highlights the leader's responsibility to harvest the knowledge that exists throughout the organization and to build a broader understanding of the ways the team's abilities can be aligned to solve the problem. Rather than the leader bearing the immense responsibility of discovering solutions unilaterally or alone, solving the problem becomes a matter of narrowing down a diverse list of creative solutions proposed by the team. The leader's expertise is applied to decision-making and directing, rather than controlling and dictating. Let's look at an example of the importance of context. 2 decades after McDonald's dropped its case against Oury and the McVegan campaign, things appeared to come full circle. In 2015, McDonald's CEO, Don Thompson, left the conglomerate to join the board of directors at up-and-coming vegan food startup Impossible Foods. That move would have been completely unthinkable back in the mid-90s, but veganism is no longer on the fringe of society. In fact, Impossible Foods has received more than $100 million in Silicon Valley venture capital funding. That's not because the financiers have a soft spot for animal rights or environmentalism, or are do-gooders in general. Following in the footsteps of the radical inclusion philosophy of Vegan Action 20 years ago, Impossible Foods is taking a counterintuitive approach to its business model. Put yourself for a moment at the head of Impossible Foods. Your mission is to make the best possible veggie burger. You have at your disposal a biochemistry team that can help you get the right texture and taste. How would you go about developing your product and marketing it? What approach would you take? Take a few moments to consider your plan of attack, because it's not as simple as it may first appear. If you're like most people, you'd start out by doing your homework. You'd survey the competition, conduct taste tests of the best soy and portobello burgers out there, and come up with a product that feels and tastes better. Then you would reach out to the retailers most likely to carry such a product, like Whole Foods and online vegan outlets, and try to get it recognized as the industry standard. That's the wrong approach, and not the one taken by Impossible Foods. For one thing, the company would never have been able to get substantial VC funding to come up with the best veggie burger. There's nothing new or exciting about that. But more important, reaching out to vegetarians and health-conscious shoppers misses the point. What if you turned the business plan on its head and took a completely different approach, one in which we take a look at the broader context? Meet Impossible Foods founder and CEO, Pat Brown. He's not your typical Silicon Valley entrepreneur. Well into his 60s, tall, with a runner's build, This former Stanford biochemistry professor looks and sounds the part of the stereotypical hippie. He has been a vegetarian since the 1970s and likes to chat about mature technology photosynthesis and carbon stored in biomass. Hearing him speak about the food industry, you'd think he was a Green Party candidate. There's a tremendous influence of the very institutions that we're trying to disrupt, which have a lot of control in government. In 2010, Brown tried to get his message across to the public by creating a National Research Council workshop in Washington called The Role of Animal Agriculture in a Sustainable 21st Century Global Food System. If you haven't heard of it, you're not the only one. Virtually no one cared. Brown knew there had to be a better way. Instead of criticizing the meat industry, he decided to emulate it. He noted that people who make and sell beef burgers don't preach at their customers. They give them the product they want. Brown understood that in order to make a difference, he would have to be inclusive. He needed to deliver a vegetarian alternative for meat eaters. His core competition, he realized, was not other veggie burgers. He wasn't trying to give vegetarians a better culinary experience, though that was a welcome side effect. They were already sold. Brown was looking to convert meat and potatoes guys with no interest in vegetarianism or the environment. Impossible Foods' goal is to replicate, even improve on, a top-grade beef burger. All you have to do, Brown explains, is make a product that the current consumers of meat and dairy prefer to what they're getting now. With modern science, there's no reason you can't create a vegetable-based product that convincingly mimics its meat-based alternative. And instead of introducing the burger at Whole Foods or at vegan restaurants, Brown decided to roll out his creation at restaurants that serve both carnivores and herbivores, and not just any restaurants. The Impossible Burger made its debut at upscale Foodie Havens, whose chefs each put their own unique spin on it. In creating their own mouth-watering versions of the Impossible Burger, with house-made buns and toppings like caramelized onions, truffle cream, Gruyere cheese, mushroom puree, and gochujang aioli, whatever that is, the chefs were co-creating the context of the Impossible Burger, helping to position it as not an ordinary veggie burger, but an alternative for meat-eating gourmands. Chapter 11. Expand the Circle. Leadership Principle Number 6. Relinquish Control to Build and Sustain Power. The era of digital echoes requires leaders to develop an instinct for inclusion, an uncommon commitment to reach beyond collaboration all the way to trust, a willingness to purposefully relinquish control to preserve power. Because everyone is listening, everyone is watching, everyone is scrutinizing all the time, everywhere, at the speed of memes, heightening interest, stirring emotions, raising expectations, and creating both vulnerabilities and opportunities. It's not science fiction. It's part of our lives, today. It makes this an exciting time to lead. In these times, we can choose to see the world as a perpetually competitive arena where interactions result in winner-take-all outcomes, or we can see the world as an increasingly and inevitably collaborative space where common benefits accrue through common costs. Of course, it's easier to explain the competitive nature of the world than it is to explain the collaborative nature of the world. It's easier to describe a clean win than a shared accomplishment. But seeking absolute concrete dominance is a costly strategy, certainly difficult in the past and increasingly unsustainable today. Additionally, concentrated power is making our world more dangerous. As countries concentrate control, their communities and citizens become more divided and insular. Solving problems by emphasizing exclusion jealously husbanding power, and aspiring to greater control is producing suboptimal, fragile, and costly outcomes. Rather than attempting to dominate, we suggest that leaders instead learn to relinquish control. Instead of grasping at the control we may feel slipping through our fingers, we should embrace the changing nature of power. We should allow control to flow out of our hands and into the capable, trained hands of the members of our organizations. The overall goal of leadership is to increase effectiveness and build a history of successes within the organization. In order to champion these successes, a leader must build and preserve power and order within the team. Power affords the leader the ability to act, and order provides predictability in the team's actions. Preserving power and order over the long term and at a sustainable cost is the biggest challenge we face as leaders in our changing world. Without power, we cannot expect to lead. But leaders often exert control when it is not needed, and at a cost that is not justified. In this new environment, concentrations of power cannot endure. While power remains necessary for effective leadership, the path to sustainable power is no longer through control. Real power is measured not in degree of control, but rather in the ability to find optimum, affordable, enduring solutions to complex problems. In Iraq and Afghanistan, for example, U.S. military leaders and diplomats learned that to preserve their power to influence tribal, religious, and political leaders, they had to willingly and transparently relinquish control over time. Control is seductive because it creates the perception of power. Control often produces narrow, suboptimal solutions that struggle to endure. Control is expensive. We're not arguing that leaders should cede all control. We are arguing that in these times of complexity, speed, and scrutiny, the best solutions, the most affordable solutions, the most enduring solutions will be the product of inclusion. Carefully developed and persistently nurtured, inclusion creates speed and efficiency in the workplace, in our communities, in our countries, and in the world. As leaders, we need to employ inclusion in order to sustain our system of alliances and partnerships. We need to build a consensus with our teams and with like-minded partners toward longer-term solutions at sustainable levels of effort. Order and inclusion need to exist in tension with each other, supporting each other in an appropriate balance where both are adequately represented. Order and inclusion can and should be complementary. To build and maintain power, we need both control and inclusion. When a leader feels he is losing his power, the instinct is to hold on more tightly to reclaim that power, to reestablish order through the imposition of control. Traditionally, power was maintained by concentrating and building control, and in the new, rapidly changing environment in which we operate today, powerful governments, companies, and individuals are finding it increasingly easy to amass vast amounts of control. But having too much control can be a liability for leaders, teams, and organizations alike. The energy sector provides a good example. To hear the traditional gas and electrical energy professionals talk about it, the energy sector faces three urgent and converging challenges. One, dramatic changes in the industry related to technological change and national decarbonization goals. 2, replacing an aging workforce. And 3, a demand for innovative leadership. For most of the last century, the energy sector has enjoyed a relative monopoly. However, that monopoly is rapidly eroding. 19 states have adopted competitive energy markets, and the other 31 are in various stages of reforming their regulatory structures. Jim Rogers, former CEO and president of America's largest energy company, Duke Energy, describes the changing energy environment as the democratization of electricity. Customers are increasingly going off the gas and electric grid in favor of renewable energy. As an example, he notes that 1.3 gigawatts of demand came off the roof in solar energy last year, and that demand will not return to the traditional utilities. Moreover, he asserts that a 1% decline in demand produces a 3% increase in cost, shared by customers and producers. Jim also describes an industry where there have been few positive interactions with customers. Everyone, he says, knows the cost of a gallon of gas. No one knows the cost of a kilowatt hour of electricity. The result is suspicion, mistrust, and an adversarial relationship with customers who have felt imprisoned by a lack of choice in energy providers. At the same time, alternative and renewable energy sources have become increasingly affordable and practical. Together, these factors have made the cost of maintaining control of the traditional natural gas and electric utilities prohibitively high. Jim's answer, utilities need to take on the task of designing customer experience with energy. Stated another way, to preserve their power, their market share and influence, they must relinquish some control to renewables and to their customers. Dean Seavers became president of National Grid in 2014. National Grid is among the top five of the nation's electricity and natural gas utilities, servicing one of its most challenging markets in the Northeast. In his vision statement for National Grid, titled The Democratization of Energy, Dean reflects on the tremendous change facing his industry and outlines three imperatives for managing that change. First, we must put customers in charge. Second, we must embrace our technology partners. Last, yet most important, we must change how we regulate and finance the industry. Dean describes his efforts to establish a decarbonized energy network, to experiment with microgrids that can monitor energy flows to create two-way flows between company and customer, and to empower the entire energy supply chain, including system operators, generators, distributors, and customers. Customers, he correctly notes, want more control over how and when they use energy. He's not fighting this trend. Why? Because in the end it will drive a more sustainable long-term model, he says. Ultimately, Dean's vision is to redefine utilities as a kind of smartphone for energy distribution, with energy generators, service providers, and technology partners delivering a range of energy solution apps. Dean admits he doesn't have all the answers yet, but he does know he must put customers in charge, embrace technology partners, and see real change in how the industry is financed, he says, in order to kill our 20th century infrastructure paradigm for one that works in the 21st century and beyond. What do Jim, Dean, and most in the energy sector understand? That they must act now, and that they must co-create the context in which energy decisions will be made with numerous, and even some unlikely, partners, and that they must relinquish control to create an optimum, enduring, and sustainable outcome. Inviting everyone to provide energy to the grid and giving customers a voice in designing and meeting their energy requirements is relinquishing control to preserve power in practice. However, at least for now, there are more examples of leaders succumbing to the fear of losing power by aggressively seeking to exert greater control. It was May of 2003, and General Dempsey was about to depart Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, where he was serving as the program manager of the Saudi Arabian National Guard Modernization Program and advisor to Crown Prince Abdullah bin Abdulaziz. He was headed to Baghdad to become commander of the U.S. Army 1st Armored Division, which had recently been assigned responsibility for securing the Iraqi capital. Crown Prince Abdullah had been good to General Dempsey's group of several hundred soldiers and civilians who were working in several locations in the kingdom to help him modernize his National Guard. General Dempsey made sure to pay the Crown Prince a courtesy visit before leaving the area. While protocol matters in most countries across the globe, it matters especially in monarchies. General Dempsey's car turned into the Crown Prince's palace. It was heavily guarded, but Dempsey had been there before, and the guards rendered a crisp salute as his car drove through the security checkpoint. The palace grounds were an impressive combination of polished marble and verdant gardens, a beautiful sight to take in while traversing the 100-yard driveway, and a stark contrast to life outside the palace. Crown Prince Abdullah was aware of the contrast and had proven himself both an astute reformer and a compassionate leader. He was destined to be the next king, and there was general enthusiasm for the moment that day would arrive. It wouldn't be long. The tires of Dempsey's armored sedan squealed on the marble driveway as they turned slowly toward the dismount point in front of the palace. The advisor to the Crown Prince greeted him warmly as he stepped out of the car. The advisor spoke perfect English and had been a very helpful interlocutor for Dempsey over the past 2 years. "Good morning, Adil," he said, extending his hand in greeting. "Good morning, General," Adil responded. "The Crown Prince is eager to see you. It will be just a few minutes, as some local farmers have come to ask his assistance, and they are in with His Royal Highness right now." "I understand, Adil, no worries," Dempsey replied in Arabic. Adil smiled. In the kingdom that was Saudi Arabia, anyone could, and many often did, directly petition the royal family for assistance. The relationship between the royal family and the population was what held the country together. It was a tenuous relationship at times, strained by the intersection of religious conservatism and modernity, but they made it work, for now, at least, Dempsey thought. In any case, General Dempsey was aware that it could be minutes or hours before he would have his audience with the Crown Prince. He had learned quickly that patience and courtesy were indispensable attributes for those working in Saudi Arabia. A servant carrying a pot of Arabic coffee approached. It was bitter to the taste, but on most occasions a welcome part of the ritual. Tea would come next, then water or juice. If Dempsey was there long enough, the cycle would repeat. "Thank you," he said, again in Arabic. The servant smiled, but there was never any exchange with these Bedouins who loyally served the Crown Prince. General Dempsey's escort sat down beside him. "How's your family?" he asked. This, too, was part of the ritual. Reinforce the relationship before business. "Very well. Thanks for asking, Adil. And how about yours?" For the next 15 minutes, the pair discussed events outside the kingdom. Al-Qaeda, Iraq, Egypt, Israel, the Palestinians, Iran. Especially Iran. Iran had supplanted Israel as the topic of greatest interest. Adil excused himself. General Dempsey sat looking around the expansive waiting room. It was about the size of a basketball court and was adorned with several beautifully embroidered and elaborately framed verses from the Quran. There was also a single modestly sized portrait, King Abdulaziz, the founder of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Otherwise, there were no images or statuary here. That would have been contrary to the tenets of Islam. The single silk rug, probably woven in Iran, that covered all but a few feet on each side of the room must have been unimaginably expensive. There were at least 100 beautifully upholstered chairs around the room. At certain times of the year, this room would be filled with well-wishers and petitioners. They would come and go throughout the evening, and each time a member of the royal family entered the room, everyone would stand and shuffle to new positions based on the rank of the newcomer relative to those already in the room. Dempsey could never figure out how they kept track of it all, and was glad that today he would not be competing much longer for the Crown Prince's attention. Adil returned. "The Crown Prince will see you now," he said. "Please follow me." It was only a short walk to the room where the Crown Prince awaited General Dempsey's arrival. The room was a smaller, more intimate version of the waiting room. The Crown Prince stood and approached Dempsey, who greeted him in Arabic and kissed him on both cheeks. The Crown Prince took his hand, guiding him to two armchairs at the front of the room. Between the armchairs was a straight-backed chair. Adil would sit there to translate. "How is my general?" the Crown Prince asked. "I'm well, Your Royal Highness. And how are you?" Relationship before business. Legend has it that an American general visiting from Washington once looked at his watch several times during a visit and the Crown Prince was highly insulted. General Dempsey never wore a watch while serving in the kingdom. Coffee, tea, fruit juice. The Crown Prince was ready to get to the subject of the visit.
"General, I'm told that you will be leaving us. We are sorry to see you leave. You have been an honest adviser and have helped us prepare our National Guard for an uncertain future. Thank you very much."
Dempsey's turn.
"Your Royal Highness, it has been my honor to serve in the kingdom with the National Guard. They benefit greatly from your support, and the relationship between our army and your National Guard has never been stronger. General, I know your next duty will be in Iraq. I wish you success. It will be a very difficult mission. You can be sure that the Iranians will try to disrupt your efforts."
"Yes, sir, I'm sure there will be many who will not want us to succeed."
"Do you have any advice for me?"
Dempsey asked.
The Crown Prince paused, leaning toward Dempsey and looking at him closely.
"Be careful not to alter the face of Islam,"
he said somberly. It would be a few months before Dempsey understood what he meant. General Dempsey knew that the courtesy call was almost over. A photographer entered the room and the interpreter rose from his chair. He wanted to learn more, but it was time to go. Dempsey stood up. A picture, a handshake, a final expression of appreciation, and Dempsey's time in Saudi Arabia was at an end. General Dempsey has often reflected on the moment the Crown Prince urged him to be careful not to alter the face of Islam. For several hundred years, the Sunni sect of Islam has dominated the Middle East. With the demise of dictators and monarchs, competition erupted. Majorities and minorities, conservatives and moderates, tribes and newly empowered politicians, expatriates and indigenous. But the competition between Sunni and Shia for the soul of Islam fuels the violence that persists today in the Middle East. The invasion of Iraq in 2003 didn't alter the face of Islam, but in its attempt to introduce democratic principles to the region, it did alter the balance of power between Sunni and Shia. And as these two sects of Islam began to seek advantage over each other and to compete for control of Iraq, they would thrust the region into decades of conflict. The theater at Camp Lejeune was full. It was the spring of 2015, and 600 Marines had been invited, or more likely marched, to the theater for a town hall meeting with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. General Dempsey always appreciated the opportunity to meet servicemen and servicewomen and their families as he traveled around the country. These personal contacts had become even more important as social media and 24/7 news coverage had inundated young servicemen and servicewomen and their families as they prepared for a very uncertain and dangerous future. He could often tell from their questions where they were getting their news. This day's group seemed most interested in recent studies on retirement reform and in the ongoing debate about opening combat assignments to women. They were respectful but direct, which Dempsey appreciated. From the back of the theater, a Marine gunnery sergeant asked what Dempsey intended to do about ISIS. The Marine reminded him that the U.S. military had paid a heavy price in the Middle East in 1991 during Operation Desert Storm, in 2003 in Operation Iraqi Freedom, and again in 2007 during the surge. He said that in his judgment it had been a mistake to withdraw from Iraq in 2011, and he suggested that the military should reverse that decision, deploy a ground force large enough to finish off ISIS quickly, and then bring them home. Heads nodded in agreement.
"That's a great question, Gunny," Dempsey responded. "You've obviously got some history in the region. Thanks for your service over there. I'd like to share a perspective about what's going on with ISIS right now and see what you think of it."
"Hoorah, sir," he responded.
That's Marine speak for "go right ahead, sir." ISIS is just the latest manifestation of much deeper issues confronting the region, Dempsey began. The region is rife with corruption, ineffective governance, religious hostility, and economic instability. Unless and until these issues are addressed, military success won't matter. ISIS could disappear tomorrow, and a new group with a new name and a new extremist ideology will appear to take its place.
"So what do we do, sir?" asked the gunnery sergeant. We can't just do nothing. I agree with you, Gunny. But let me come at this from another direction for a minute. Dempsey was about to abruptly change topics. Did you ever play golf?
He nodded, yes.
Well, suppose I get up on the first tee, take a stance, check my grip, address the ball, swing, and hook it into the woods 100 yards down the fairway. Then on the second tee, I take up the same stance, place my hands in the same grip, address the ball the same way, swing, and hook it into the woods 100 yards down the fairway. Then on the third tee, I do exactly the same things with exactly the same result. Should I go to the fourth tee thinking that I'm going to do everything the way I did it on the previous 3 holes? Of course not. That would be silly. Don't get me wrong, I've actually done that in golf. The audience laughed. But that's not what we should be doing in Iraq. Look, we're on our 4th try in Iraq. Each of the previous 3 times, we've made a commitment in Iraq. We've rolled in heavy, taken control, reduced the levels of violence, imposed order on the political and economic systems, and then given it all back to the Iraqis. And each time they have proven unequal to the task. You can argue that we didn't do enough to get them ready. I argue that we did too much and removed the incentive for them to be ready. What's going to be different this time, sir? Came a question from a Marine in the front row. This time we don't take control, Dempsey replied. This time we go into support. Enough to do what we want to do, but not so much that they get the impression we're making this primarily our fight. This time we provide a limited number of resources that they simply don't have. Air power, intelligence, logistics, and training. We place enough of our own direct strike capability in country to hit targets that could directly threaten our personnel and facilities or our homeland. But this time, we make it clear that we're there to support their campaign plan. We advise, they decide. It will take longer and progress will be uneven, but it will be theirs. Simultaneously, we help them plan for success. For the day ISIS is defeated, and we make it clear that our support depends on them working together. Makes sense, said the gunnery sergeant. Will it work? I honestly don't know, Gunny, Dempsey replied. But I do know that doing it the same way we did it before won't work. We'll give them another chance and show them what being included in determining the outcome really looks like. If we're patient, I do think it will work. Dempsey has long considered the period between his visit to the Crown Prince in Riyadh in 2003 and his visit to the Marines at Camp Lejeune in 2015 and what it means for the future. The issues tearing the Middle East apart will not be resolved for a generation. Moreover, the issues are not confined to the Middle East. They are prevalent in an arc of instability that stretches from Afghanistan in the east to Nigeria in the west. The cost of unilaterally controlling matters in this arc of instability for 20 years would be unimaginable. But there is an answer, and it is an answer based on the principle of radical inclusion. We should counter radical extremism with radical inclusion. The instability in the Middle East, South Asia, and North Africa affects us, our allies, and our partners. Terrorism, migration, arms trafficking, and drugs flow through ungoverned or poorly governed space, but they don't stop there. They threaten us and our allies. They relentlessly assault our values and our sense of well-being. Those responsible for this instability, the loosely affiliated radical Islamist groups who profess exclusion and who practice violent religious extremism across the region, can be defeated only by a broad and inclusive coalition. A coalition with the capability, the resources, and the staying power to collaborate on the whole problem. Security, governance, reconstruction, economic development, and humanitarian relief. Against this enemy, we should use military force only if we are willing to complement it with the use of the other instruments of our national power. That should also be the price of admission to the coalition. Progress in the campaign should be measured less in terms of enemies killed and cities liberated, and more in terms of functioning institutions,
the restoration of basic goods and services, and the completion of reconstruction projects. Such a coalition must be owned by those countries in the region that have both the most to lose and the most to gain by the outcome. Otherwise, the outcomes will simply not endure. Countries outside the region, including the United States, must be willing to relinquish control at times and in places in the interest of generating a genuine sense of belonging, ownership, and accountability among those engaged in this conflict. Relinquishing control is about partnering with like-minded individuals, teams, and organizations to solve problems in ways that will endure. It is about solving problems and conserving power at a cost that is sustainable for us and our organizations. It is not about being liberal or progressive or being inclusive for the sake of being egalitarian. Leaders must learn to relinquish control in order to solve problems effectively and efficiently, and to keep those problems solved in the long term. By relinquishing control, we preserve and enhance our power. As General Dempsey's car turned off Massachusetts Avenue in Northwest Washington and into the British Embassy, the security guard greeted him with a broad smile. "Good to see you again, General, and good on you. Enjoy the evening. Please pull forward and park just there in the roundabout. It's just a short walk from there to the residence." Dempsey had been to the British ambassador's residence a half dozen times in the past 5 years, usually to meet a visiting British dignitary. On one memorable occasion, Prince Charles was in town to support a charitable event for U.S. and British soldiers wounded in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Dempsey spoke just before the prince, and to lighten the moment he sang a verse of an Irish ballad. Not to be outdone, and to the utter astonishment of the other British dignitaries in the room, Prince Charles ended his remarks with a verse from the Pirates of Penzance. It was good fun for a good cause. Tonight would be good fun, too. It was October 2016, and Dempsey was there to be invested as a Knight of the British Empire, the first U.S. military officer to be so honored in the last 12 years, and one of only 26 U.S. military officers ever accorded the honor. The British ambassador's residence is one of the most beautiful and impressive buildings in a city full of beautiful and impressive buildings. Opened in 1928, its marbled floors, sturdy Ionic columns, gilded artwork and carefully manicured English garden are a journey back in time. Dempsey was escorted to the library to await the ceremony. The titles on its shelves were an impressive sampling of England's rich literary history. Years earlier, Dempsey had read and even taught many of these books. A working knowledge of literature had always helped him find metaphors to understand and describe the complexities of national security. But he wouldn't be quoting English literature to his English hosts tonight. Tonight was about celebrating common values, shared commitments, and collaboration on complex problems. About 75 of Dempsey's family and closest friends were present. The news for the past month or more had been consistently unsettling and often divisive. His British colleagues were understandably anxious about how the two countries' relationship would evolve. Dempsey wanted to say something meaningful and reassuring. At the appointed time, he was escorted from the library and into the room where the ceremony would take place. He smiled at the front row of guests where his wife, his three children, and six of his nine grandchildren were sitting. In the few moments before the ambassador entered the room, Dempsey glanced above the large fireplace on one side of the room to a portrait of Queen Elizabeth I. Directly across on the other side of the room was a portrait of Queen Elizabeth II. Though more than 400 years apart, each of them faced strikingly similar challenges and deftly guided England through war and peace, through great shifts in power, and through dramatic societal change. Something, some instinct, made them equal to their times. "We must be equal to our time," Dempsey thought. The room rose as one when the ambassador entered the room. He summoned Dempsey to his side. His remarks were extensive and complimentary. As the ambassador spoke,
Dempsey found himself reflecting on what he'd learned about America's relationship with the British and what he had done with the knowledge. From 1941 to 1948, the combined chiefs of staff of the United States and the United Kingdom met annually in Washington and in London, initially to chart the course of the war and subsequently to collaboratively plan for the security of post-war Europe. The combined chiefs included the senior military officer of each country with his chiefs of Army, Navy, and Marines. Their insights, strategies, and advice were provided to the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Great Britain for consideration in making important policy and resource decisions. The 1947 combined chiefs meeting was particularly important. It was held in Roosevelt Hall at Fort McNair in Washington, D.C. The war in Europe and the war in the Pacific had been over for more than a year, and the military arsenals of both the United States and the United Kingdom were being dismantled. Defense budgets in each country were being rededicated to economic priorities. Faced with declining resources and increasing requirements, the combined chiefs met to determine how they could better collaborate on managing the mutual national security risks they identified. In late 2012, Dempsey had met his British counterpart, Chief of Defense Staff General Sir David Richards, in London to discuss the state of their two countries' armed forces. They both faced declining resources after a decade of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they both assessed security in Europe and in the Pacific as trending downward. Sir David suggested that they take a page from their shared history and revive the combined Chiefs of Staff meeting. Dempsey agreed and offered to host the first event in Washington, D.C. in the summer of 2013. They decided to model their meeting on the 1947 meeting. Her Majesty the Queen is pleased to confer on this great friend of England the title of Honorary Knight of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. The ambassador concluded. Dempsey snapped back to the present. He began his remarks by asking the ambassador to express his deep appreciation and humility to Her Majesty the Queen for this great honor. He told the ambassador that he accepted the award on behalf of the thousands of U.S. soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who had served and continued to serve in peace and in war alongside the men and women of Britain's defense forces. For the past 40 years, wherever and whenever I've served, Britain's sons and daughters have been at my side, Dempsey said. I'd like to elaborate on the importance of the combined Chiefs of Staff strategy meetings, he told the assembled guests. But I want to begin by telling my grandchildren that this award I've received tonight is about friendship, respect, and trust. It's about two countries who believe in each other and who share the same values. What I want my grandchildren to remember from tonight is that we get through life by choosing our friends carefully, working with them on the hardest problems, and trusting them. In 2013, the combined chiefs of staff of the U.S. and U.K. met in the same room in the same building as our predecessors in 1947. We sat in the same seats and even took a black-and-white group photograph with each of us standing where our predecessors had stood for their group photograph. We met to share our assessments of global security, to discuss our resource challenges, and to determine if we could do more together than we could do separately. We challenged ourselves to consider becoming not just more collaborative and interoperable, but interdependent in select areas. Separately, we knew we couldn't do more with less. Together, we thought we might. The meeting played out in the context of a resurgent Russia, an assertive China, an aggressive North Korea, an insidious Iran, and the reality of a generational and persistent conflict with violent extremist groups from Afghanistan to Nigeria. We succeeded in finding areas where we could each recommend relinquishing some control in order to achieve interdependence and a better outcome. We wrote our report. I presented a copy to our president. General Sir David presented a copy to his prime minister. They validated our recommendations. We made a commitment to have working groups track our progress toward interdependence and to meet again the next year in London. This award tonight is symbolic of what we have and must continue to learn from this experience. That is, the key to dealing with life's complexity, uncertainty, and adversity is to find someone you trust and trust them. It takes trust to relinquish control, but with trust, anything is possible. Without trust, almost nothing. Leaders in the new environment must understand that relinquishing control is a matter of necessity. In a world where control is too costly, where the answers rarely lie with us and often lie with our people, and where the environment is adapting more quickly than we can react, we must relinquish control for self-preservation. To preserve our positions as leaders and to build and sustain the power of our organizations, we have no option but to let go of control. Real power, the kind of power that yields optimum, enduring, and affordable outcomes, is not a liability. But in order to build and sustain that kind of power, leaders need to develop the instinct for seeking opportunities to share control. Simply put, relinquishing control yields better, longer-lasting solutions that will preserve and enhance your power as a leader and your power as an organization. Those who do not learn to relinquish control will suffer costly effects. As our environment changes and adapts, these effects have the potential to increase exponentially and lead to catastrophe for individuals, teams, and organizations. Leaders must understand, however, that relinquishing control works only when there is an ethos in place that supports it. The workforce or members of the team must feel a genuine commitment to the organization and its vision if we are to trust our subordinates to think and act appropriately when afforded the opportunity to take more powerful roles within the organization. Relinquishing control must be accompanied by a deliberate effort to follow through with the previous five principles. Relinquishing control to build and sustain power feels counterintuitive, but in fact it has less to do with a leader losing power and more to do with how an organization shares knowledge and builds trust. But how can we be sure we let go of enough power to be effective, but not so much that we lose it all? How can leaders learn to go against their natural instincts to seize control when they feel it slipping away? These are instincts that every leader must develop in order to be successful in his mission to learn to relinquish control. It is through these instincts that leaders find the necessary trust in their team members, discover a method to utilize the ideas and knowledge that exist throughout an organization, and build and sustain the power of the organization, not through control, but by radical inclusion. Chapter 12. The Leadership Instincts. Listen, Amplify, Include. Kansas can be quite hot in June, and on this particular day it was exceeding expectations. Major Dempsey had just finished his studies at the Army's Mid-Career School at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and this was the graduation ceremony. Outside, on metal folding chairs, in wool uniforms, in the blazing sun. Nice, he thought. His mind was mostly on the task ahead, packing up his family and heading to Germany for his next assignment as a tank battalion executive officer. The transition would be tough on Deanie and the kids he knew, but they would eventually turn it into an adventure. Dempsey was only vaguely aware that the guest speaker for the ceremony was being introduced, but it was the four-star commander of U.S. Army Europe, so he figured he'd better pay attention. General Glenn Otis took the podium and congratulated the graduating class. He told the 1,000 men and women before him about the state of the Army in Europe and about the importance of the mission as part of our nation's commitment to NATO. Then he said he wanted the graduates to remember just one thing from his remarks that day. He took a 3x5 card from his breast pocket. "I carry this card with me at all times," he said, "to remind me about the most important attribute of a leader." The card reads, "When is the last time you allowed a subordinate to change your mind about something? I want you to remember this as you leave here today and rejoin the regular army. Be a good listener."
General Otis made an impression on Dempsey that day. From then on, he carried a similar reminder to himself about being a good listener. As he progressed in his own career, Dempsey added two other attributes that he considered essential in a leader: understanding how to amplify and developing a genuine instinct to be inclusive. He describes the interaction of the three instincts this way. Listen to learn. Listen to make it clear to those who follow that you value their insights, their judgments, and their advice. Listen to understand the organization and to become mindful of opportunities and vulnerabilities. Listen because it is most often weak signals that portend success or failure. Amplify to establish expectations. Amplify the best ideas, the best recommendations, the best practices, and do so in a manner that encourages teamwork at every level of the organization. Amplify the organization's values to strengthen the inner voice that reminds us what's right, a voice that can sometimes be drowned out by digital echoes. Amplify because the best leaders establish a drumbeat of emphasis on values within their organization. Amplify because everyone benefits when there is a common vocabulary about what's expected of them. Include to empower. Go wide and deep in including members of the organization to share knowledge, to create a common understanding of problems, and to encourage ownership of solutions. Include to inspire loyalty. Include as the first step in developing a climate of trust. Include because if you don't, who will? Leaders operating under the leadership theory described in this book will find it difficult to succeed without developing an instinct for listening. Those who are frequently extrapolating and pontificating are rarely able to truly empower those around them and open the lines of communication in the ways this book's principles have taught. Leaders must understand that the instinct to listen is an art, a skill, and a system that must be employed in order to build a team ethos, embrace a bias for action, and relinquish control. So how do we listen? Not only leaders, but organizations as a whole. Opportunities to listen are all around us. Personal interactions, structured and unstructured meetings, walking the halls, social media, town hall meetings, conversations in the elevator, everywhere and anywhere are opportunities to listen. The more willing we are to seek these opportunities and capitalize on them, the more likely we are to continue to develop the instinct and become stronger listeners as people and as teams. We must discover efficient, realistic ways to listen to members of our organizations at every level so that we may, A, better understand the problems our people are facing, B, recognize the potential solutions our team members have thought of, and C, provide our team members with their own opportunities to lead. General Dempsey remembers one of his first meetings with the president. He can't recall the topic, but he remembers vividly how focused he was on listening to the president's words and working to understand not only their meaning, but their context. He soaked in the words, volume, facial expression, eye contact, and body language. If Dempsey was to be his advisor for the next 4 years, he needed to know how this man thought and communicated. What if we listened more intently and worked harder to understand what others were trying to communicate? Doing so would improve our relationships and build the trust necessary to lead more effectively. When General Dempsey and the Joint Chiefs were tasked to develop a plan to train and educate the force before the military rescinded the "Don't Ask, Don't Tell" policy, they immediately sent out several key military and civilian leaders on a listening tour. Their mandate was to find out what the men and women across the armed forces, active and reserve, were thinking, were saying, and were feeling. The Joint Chiefs had decided that only when they had this information would they begin to formulate a plan and a timeline for rescinding the policy. When a leader listens,
He has the opportunity to find answers to the problems the organization faces. He empowers his team members to be an active part of the decision-making process, thus cultivating a sense of belonging. The leader can take this a step further by not only listening for innovative solutions, but also amplifying